And I'm glad to have the opportunity for us to learn one more time together before the summer break. I will ask people, as we were reminded last time, after so long on Zoom, I never had to make this request for 2 years. I didn't have to ask, so please make sure your phones are silent. Thank you. Let's learn. Week four of When Will the Messiah Come? And this class is actually dedicated. You know Rose Rahmani, although I think you probably only met her on Zoom. Because she joined
for the first time on Thursday.
There you go. She joined the classes only once COVID had started, so you wouldn't have met her in person. But it's dedicated in memory of her mother. The art site is coming up on the second day of Av, so the neshama should benefit from our learning. So, well, what I want to do this week, much like last week, is to revisit some of the things we talked about in the first 2 weeks, where we did this sort of run-through of what is Mashiach, what is the Messianic era like, and when is it going to happen? Are we supposed to learn about when it's going to happen? I wanted to break that down a little bit further and examine in greater depth. So the first thing I wanted to do was go back to something that I mentioned in, I think it was the second class, where I quoted you a passage from the Talmud. If you take a look at source number one, I brought it for you again there, based on verses in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, in which Rabbi Yochanan said, the son of David will come only in a generation that is entirely meritorious or entirely guilty. The generation that's entirely meritorious, because I have a verse in Isaiah, in Yeshaya, which says, and your nation will be entirely righteous, they will take the land forever. They will settle the land forever. The word take is a translation of a word in Hebrew that's hard to translate. In Hebrew, it's yirshu. And lareshet, right, can be to inherit, but it can also mean to conquer and to take and to settle. So that's why I translated it as to take. But the point is, as your nation will be entirely righteous. So everybody's righteous. Yeah, you might as well. Thanks. And then on the other hand, we have another verse that says, he, God, saw that there was no one, he was desolate, there was none to intercede for them. And God said, for myself, I will act. Don't deserve it, I will act on their behalf. And so we said, that means the Messiah can come when there is nobody who is righteous at all. So we talked about it a little bit. But afterwards, after the class, and doing some other learning, I actually came across source number two. Rabbi David Kimchi, also known as Radak, yeah, right, in his commentary to one of the verses that was quoted in source number one, he said, and so too, this is part of a larger comment of his. Do we have another sheet? I think I had. Okay. Oh, okay. And so too, when our sages said a generation which is entirely guilty, it means most. You don't actually need everybody to be fully righteous, or everybody to be fully guilty, such that, like we said when we discussed this initially, imagine a world in which nobody's following anything, and you're the one holdout, you insist, I'm going to do a mitzvah, and therefore Mashiach doesn't come. That would be terrible. So he says, doesn't mean entirely. It means mostly guilty. The point is, Mashiach comes when we're mostly good. Mashiach can come when people are mostly bad. He says there has never been in Israel a generation which was entirely liable without any righteous and good people. And also he says guilty doesn't have to mean terrible either. It doesn't mean liable for destruction, like they're horrible, the city of Sodom level, you know, evil. It just means that even when you have a generation, you have this generation that is not worthy of redemption, that most of them are not worthy of redemption, Mashiach, the Messiah, still comes. That's his point. Is God has a timetable, which we've talked about before, and Mashiach come, well, the Messiah will come, even in this generation that is mostly bad. So that's one clarification that I wanted to bring. Any comments on that before we go further? Yeah, Paul.
I just wanted to say, I understand we're studying our tradition.
Yes.
But does nobody within that tradition suggest that this is all a slender reed, that there's no explicit mention of...
So did you go back, did you listen to the recording from week one? Or were you there for week one? So week one, meaning the one that I did, the first two parts, the first two were the ones that were online.
Yes, but
So in any case, what I'm saying is, when we did that, we actually showed many, many sources that are biblical sources that speak of there being a king and there being a return. I don't buy the argument that it's slender. I know people like to say it, but I don't think it's true.
I'm aware of those biblical passages. It just seems to me those two are not explicit.
When you have passages that talk about there being a return to the land of Israel, that talk about there being a king who is going to lead them, what more do you need when your vision of Mashiach is simply that, that there's going to be a return to Israel and a king who's going to lead them? It says it fairly explicitly.
We already have it.
Yeah, absolutely true. What we're waiting on is that leader, but you're right. That's why people talk about this as the footsteps of Mashiach, and that's why people get so excited, because they look at it and say, it's here. The question really becomes, we talked about the fact that some sources portray it as being a period of supernatural miracles. And is that what's predicted in Tanakh? Because that's harder to find. You don't really see it in the Chumash. You see it in some of the prophets. You see it in Yeshaya, right? That's where it gets more challenging. And then the question of, are we seeing that, and how do you know, you know, and what's that going to be like? In the same way that you may remember in November 2019, I did that series at Beth Emeth on life after death. And I pointed out those who argue that they can't find a biblical basis for it. And I showed the biblical basis for it and walked through it and showed also that those who say that Judaism didn't believe in it historically are flying in the face of not only Tanakh, but also human history. There was that professor from Columbia who said, to argue that that the ancient Hebrews did not believe in that would mean to argue that they were the only nation in that era in the entire region that didn't have a belief in an afterlife. From a secular perspective, it's silly, but people still say it. So coming back towards this, the question of what will happen, and particularly the supernatural elements, is one that I want to come back to, and one that I think, you know, there's more to discuss about. But the idea that we are meant to return from our exile, and we are meant to have a leader, a human leader, who's going to lead us, I think is biblically straightforward. Yeah, that's what I would say. The anointed one. So this is a good question. Who's going to do the anointing? Historically, the anointer was a prophet. You needed a Navi, you know, to be the one to do it. So that sounds like we should need to have a prophet. You know, right now we're a not-for-profit, but we're sorry. I'm not the first one to make that joke. But God willing, you know, we'll have to see that happen. It's a good question. So I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the actual natural predictions, we think of it as a natural prediction, which is the blooming of the land of Israel. We talked about it in source number 3, we saw this, the passage in the Talmud in Sanhedrin, about the land of Israel bearing fruit. Rabbi Abba said, you want to know when the Messiah is here? You want a sign? There is no end, meaning the period of the Messiah, more revealed, more visible than the prediction in Ezekiel. And you, mountains of Israel, your branches will give forth, you will bear fruit for my nation Israel. And of course, you know, people who read that are mindful, I think, of the Mark Twain piece, right, that he published whenever it was, 120 years ago, roughly, where he talked about his visit to the land and how everything was in ruins and it was desolate, and the Palestinians get very offended when you talk about that. But that's what he saw, and that's what he recorded. Then the desert blooming, you know, with an awful lot of effort. I mean, you're talking about the Bilu movement that came in the 1870s, 1880s. You're talking about the early kibbutzim. You're talking about all the work that was done and the controversial draining of the swamps, which then had to be rehydrated. But it was done because of malaria initially in the Hula Valley area. That's all part of this process that you see predicted here, but I wanted to build on it, because biblically we view the land of Israel as having a personality. It's not simply the scenery. There's a location where Jews lived their lives, and now our nation is back to live there, but the land of Israel actually has a personality, an identity. Take a look on your sheet at source number 4. Two classic verses. Hang in there, Ricky. Take a look at source number 4, please. Vatomer Tzion, and Zion said, God has abandoned me, God has forgotten me. This is not talking about the people who live there. This is talking about Zion, Tzion, the place, which is usually understood as a reference to Jerusalem or the Temple Mount, saying, God has abandoned me. The Jews are now in exile. And further, God says to the Jews, second verse here in Isaiah, when we come back, you shall no longer be called abandoned. Your land will no longer be called desolate, for you will be called, my desire is in her. Sorry, God is not talking to the Jews. God is talking to Jerusalem. For you will be called, my desire is in her. Meaning the city of Jerusalem will be called the city that I, God, desire. And God is speaking to it. Anybody know what that is in Hebrew? Sorry? Chefzibah. I wanted to name my daughter Chefzibah. My wife wouldn't go for it. Hepzibah is hard for people, you know? But nonetheless, I'll just take down a chair here.
There you go.
So this is, there's a personification here of the land. And lest you say, well, that's just poetic, right? Isaiah is waxing poetic. Rav Avram Yitzchak Cook wrote the following in source number 5. He said, this is my translation of it, the land of Israel is not an external thing, an external prize acquired by the nation, a means toward the end of national unification and reinforcement of the nation's physical or even spiritual survival. The land of Israel is an independent entity bound to the nation in the bond of life. Israel is a conscious thing. Now, it's land. It's dirt. We dig in it, right? Like, what exactly does this mean? So that's where I want to go with this. I have a professor of literature here who's gonna tell me. That's obviously anthropomorphism. But Ricky, what were you gonna say?
I think there's also a world-looking thing that says that countries also have a mazal, have a sign, and depending on when it was founded or whatever. And I've heard that, and it did kind of make some examples. It was kind of quite interesting.
Right, and I'm gonna go there, exactly there. Meaning, you could, as simply as the idea that all physical entities, material things, on some level have a desire to serve God, whatever that means. But God performed that, God created them in order for them to play a role in his universe. They are serving God. And that's the identity of it. You could say that. You could say, legitimately, everything has some form of consciousness on whatever level. In the same way that animals, there's a lot of dispute in rabbinic writing, what kind of a neshama, what kind of a soul they have. It's not a human soul, but there's something there. You may be familiar with the hierarchy that the Kabbalists did a lot with. Domeim, Someach, Chai, Midaber. Midaber, that which speaks, is the human being. Chai is a reference to the animal kingdom. Someach are plants. And domeim is that which is mute, minerals, the inanimate world. But they're on the hierarchy. There is something there. But the way that I would understand it would be a little bit different. In the book of Daniel, a book that I want to discuss some of a little bit later, he has visions of angels that represent nations. The idea that every nation actually has a malach, right? Some spiritual being, comes from verses in Daniel. And granted that angelology in Tanakh is very, very difficult. We definitely have a belief in them. Malachim, angels, show up from the earliest parts of the Torah. God puts these cherubs at the entrance of the Garden of Eden. A malach speaks to Hagar. Like, you know, whatever is happening, something is happening, and the Torah never takes the time to tell us, you know, what is the life of an angel? What are they doing when they're not talking to Hagar? Yes, the concept of malach is, you know, to me associated with the word melacha, tasks. Someone sent me an article recently that was written by Mitchell First, who's a lawyer in New Jersey who likes to write about all sorts of topics. And so he had written an article that went through some of the research, and then once he sent me that, I sent him an article also on this about the roots of Malach in Akkadian and so forth. But the bottom line is that yes, it is something which carries out a task, and evidently there is a class of Malachim which each one has the task of leading, taking care of, looking out for a particular nation on earth. For which you could debate whether that means the Malach is the entity that serves the nation, or is the nation just a manifestation of the Malach? Maybe the real world is the one up there, and we are just sort of playing it out in our dimension. It's an interesting question. Janine?
Is Malach synonymous with Tsar when it talks about Tsar?
Yes. That, you know, remember that Malachim have different titles. Kuvim, Srafim, Ofanim, Chayot. Yes, when we talk about the Tsar of a nation, Tsar is a term that means an officer or a noble. It's the Malach that is associated with that nation. Ruchama.
And actually, every Malach could have only one shichut.
Correct. By definition, a Malach has one role. Right. The only debate is how broad can that mission be? If it's a Malach, its mission is healing. So it could heal this one, it could heal that one. It can be more broad, perhaps. There also, it's worth noting, and this isn't a series about, you know, Malachim, about angels. I did note that on the list of ideas for next year, I might talk about angels as in a mini-series. But there you go. So I don't want to give you too much now, because then you'll be bored when we get around to it. But there are different types of Malachim, and it's possible that there are disposable Malachim, there are burner Malachim, like they have a job to do and then they're done. And then you have the longer-lasting ones, and there's a lot to be said about that, and maybe we'll say it even at some point. Jonathan.
Is this like these groups, and I can't remember, who believe in the earth as an actual being, I can't remember the term, or something
Gaians.
Like Mother Earth?
Yeah, the Gaians. That's the, right, G-A-I-A-N-S.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but I assume. But yes, they're tapping into something which may be similar to what Rav Kook is saying, except they're not identifying the special character of the land of Israel. They're talking about it, you know, globally. But there are ideas in Judaism that build off of that. As an example, the idea that when we don't live up to our mission, then we get evicted from the land of Israel is portrayed biblically as Vataki Haaretz et Yosheveha.
Oh.
The land spat out, I'll be polite. Thank you, you're not polite. But that's the idea that the land of Israel is, you know, it's a consciousness. It's doing something. We also have, conversely, the idea of the land longing for us. If you take a look at source number 6, look at this midrash. Jeremiah says the following, and you may be familiar with this. There's a version of this appears in the kinos of Tisha B'Av, the elegies of mourning. When I ascended to Jerusalem, I raised my eyes and saw a woman sitting atop a mountain wearing black clothing with her hair undone, which is supposed to demonstrate grief, crying out, seeking one who would console her. I cried out as well and sought one who would comfort me. Because Jeremiah is actually out of Jerusalem when the temple is destroyed. God sends him on a mission. He comes back and the temple's been destroyed. So she's crying, he's crying. I drew close to her and spoke with her and told her, if you are a woman, speak with me. If you're, you know, a human being, then let's talk. If you are a spirit, if you're some kind of ghost, demon, whatever, leave me. She replied, do you not recognize me? I am the one who had 7 sons whose father left to go overseas. While I was yet crying for him, it was prophesied to me, the house has collapsed upon your 7 sons and I killed them. I don't know for whom to cry, for whom to release my hair, for whom should I be grieving? And I replied and told her, you are no greater than my mother Zion, who has been turned into the wild animals of the field. Now, he saw her like she's a person. And he says, look at what Zion suffered. To which she replied and said to me, I am your mother Zion. It's the Zion as human being. Still obviously, you know, fits in the idea that this is a literary device as opposed to literally a soul. But I think it does connect to this angel idea. I'm just debating because I'm seeing it's already 20 minutes in and there's so much more for us to talk about. So I think I'm going to just say one other thing on this point, and then if there's time at the end, I'll come back to source number 7 with Rabbi Techtel. But take a look at source number 8, because this is something that people may have heard of. There is a verse in Jeremiah which describes Israel as Eretz Tzvi. What is the word Tzvi in Hebrew? What's a Tzvi? It's a deer. It's some form of deer. You know, they have all these mountain creatures, beasts, whatever, the mountain goats and the antelopes and the elks and whatever else, which, you know, being a New Yorker, I just, you know, they have four legs. They all look the same to me. But it's usually translated as the deer, this really fast running animal. However, the word tzvi has a different meaning, which is desire. To desire something, makes it into Aramaic as well, is tzavi. So, literally, Eretz Tzvi, as Israel is described, means the land of the deer. I mean, sorry, the land of desire, not that. It's the land of desire. Another term like it is Eretz Chemda, the land of desire, God's desire. However, the Talmud says, no, read it as the land of the deer. What do you mean? A deer's hide cannot hold its flesh after being removed. Meaning if somebody kills a deer, and then they skin it, and I know that's gross, I'm sorry. I have more than one vegetarian in the room. But in the event that somebody were to do that, then tried to put the flesh back in, it wouldn't work. The hide shrivels up once it's off of the animal. This is also true for Israel. When they live upon it, the land expands. When they do not live upon it, the land shrivels. So when we come back, the land makes space for our return. Yes, Stephen.
If you're a stamp collector, you know that the earliest postage stamps in Israel had the deer on them.
Did they really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I think it's even the symbol of the of Israeli...
The door.
It's not the turtle?
No.
Someone didn't confuse Tzav and Tzvi? That wasn't the... Okay. Curious.
That's just the way you feel about the Tzav.
Got it. Okay. I did not realize that. Now in my head I can see the emblem of the post office and I see that. Okay. So this is the idea that in the future the land of Israel is going to flower and flourish. It's not simply that there's a land and now it's suddenly producing, but that the land is happy that we are back and the land is motivated to participate in that return. Okay. One of the big questions that comes up when we talk about the Messianic era is, do I have to give up my cottage in Muskoka? Is that it? Like we all now, because we saw the prediction, right? If you take a look at source number 9. And you will return to Hashem your God. You will listen to his voice according to all that I command you today, you and your children with all your heart and soul. And God will return your exile and have mercy upon you. He will return and gather you from all the nations to which Hashem your God has scattered you. If you are scattered to the edges of the heavens, from there Hashem your God will collect you, and from there he will take you, and Hashem your God will bring you to the land your ancestors settled. You will settle it. He will benefit you and make you multiply more than your ancestors did. So it sounds like, yeah, we're all supposed to go back to the land. That's it. You know, close up the cottage. Unfortunately, it's going to be a bad time to sell because, you know, everybody else is going to be selling at the same time. But that's it's not a great time to sell now either. So, you know, go.
Thank God I don't have that problem.
Okay, right. Me too. Another example of it, Isaiah, source number 10. A great shofar will be blown and those lost in Assyria will come. And those who have been scattered in the land of Egypt, and they shall bow to God on the holy mountain in Jerusalem. It sounds like we all are brought back into the land of Israel. The Talmud seems to think that this is going to happen as well. We saw in an earlier week the idea the land of Israel is going to produce delicacies to feed all the people who are coming back there. We just noted in source number 8, the passage in the Talmud about Eretz Tzvi, the land of the deer. If you take a look at source number 11, the Talmud predicts the synagogues and study halls of Babylon will be established in the land of Israel. All the synagogues and everything, they're all going to come to Israel. There's even a lot of discussion. I didn't bring it here. I should have really brought it here. There's discussion in the Talmud about appropriate use of a synagogue after the congregation is no longer using it, right? There's a classic line attributed to a rabbi in the U.S. who has made aliyah, but I'm not sure he said it, so I don't want to misquote him. But he said, we built synagogues for the Gentiles. We built synagogues for the non-Jews because we built churches for the non-Jews because when a synagogue is sold, often it ends up as, a church. The reason being because, like, what can you do with that kind of a space? I mean, when I was in Allentown, so the shul moved to its current building in 1967 or so, and you could see the old building if you drove by that spot, and it was now a church, and you could see a stained glass window with a Jewish star on it.
A lot of churches have the Jewish star. That were not synagogues before.
Oh. That's interesting.
A lot of them. I was quite shocked when I saw that.
That's very interesting.
So the church took over and left the Jewish star.
Yeah. It's a nice stained glass window. There's a lot of discussion of this in Jewish law, because you're not supposed to sell your synagogue for certain uses. It was a synagogue. It can't just become a church. It can't even become a place for revelry and so on. And so, people came up with different ways of dealing with this problem. So they would sell it to somebody who's going to use it as a warehouse. And that person, at some point, decides, maybe a couple of months later, you know what, I'm going to sell this to a church. Things like that, went on. The question of what you're able to do is an interesting question within Jewish law. But there's also an issue of what you can do in a synagogue in general. In other words, if this is a space that's dedicated for worship, it's inappropriate to do certain activities in the synagogue. Can you have a party in the same room that people use for worship? Things like that. So in that context, the Talmud has a statement that the synagogues and study halls that are built in Babylon, and Babylon is a stand-in for outside of Israel, are built on condition. Because they're only temporary. They're all going to be brought back to Israel instead of being in exile. That's the idea that seems to say, so yes, we're all going back. We're no Jew left behind. We're all going back into the land of Israel. That's what it sounds like. I saw a hand. I didn't remember. Yeah, Ricky.
It's about that. About going back to Israel. So it's only the people living at the time. Or do they already have the neshamot of everywhere?
Right. So we distinguish between two eras. There's the Messianic era, and then there's Tchiyat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead. And the two seem to reflect different time periods. There's a lot of debate and discussion on that. One classic view is that the Messianic period is first, and then at some point within them, there will be this Tchiyat HaMeitim, this resurrection of the dead, and that ushers in a new era, Olam Haba, which has its own rules.
But if the neshamot go from one person to the other,
who says?
So if I sent to Israel, then I'm also benefit all the other people in whom was the same neshamot.
Right, but the idea of the souls going from one to the other is really beyond this discussion right now, whether that's a whole other piece. It was in that November 2019 class. I really like that class. But it's not something I'm ready to reincarnate here. Sorry. But
it's
if
not
you
about reincarnation, it's about who.
Yes. No. I understand. If you take a look at source number 12, Maimonides seems to think we all go back to Israel. Look at him. In the days of the Messiah, when his reign will be established and the Jews will be gathered from their exile, all of the tribes will have their lineages clarified by him, meaning by the Messiah, meaning you'll know you were from the tribe of Naphtali, you will know you were from this lineage or that lineage, which, today, Kohanim say we're from Kohanim, but basically who else knows anything? So at that point, through divine inspiration, it will become known. Look at source number 13. Don Isaac Abarbanel, writing in the beginning of the 16th century, end of the 15th century, comments on a verse in Ezekiel. The verse says, "And they will know that I am Hashem, their God. I exiled them to the nations, and I will bring them into their land, and I will not leave of them there further." I'm not leaving anybody in exile. That's what it says. And so Don Isaac Abarbanel says, it will not be like when we came back in the Second Temple, when some of them came and many remained in the diaspora. We know that Zerubbabel leads the wave of Jews back when Cyrus, the Persian king, sends them back with 42,000 Jews, 42,360, I think is the number, 42,630, I always get confused, one of the two. And then some more come back under Ezra, and some more come back elsewhere at other times, but fundamentally, most Jews don't come back for the Second Temple. And that's what they're saying here, is that's going to be different. In that future redemption, I will not leave of them in the diaspora even one. Seems fairly clear. Except one view. Moish, you're going to really appreciate this one.
I'm just trying to hold myself back.
I admire you. The Roy Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, makes this very interesting comment. I have to credit an article on the Sfarim blog for this. Somebody sent me a link to this article a few years ago, and I wrote it down, and I kept it, and I'm glad that I kept it, because it relates here. The article was in 2020. It was called Rabbi Steinman and the Messiah, is the article on the Sfarim blog. I think it might be Mark Shapiro, but I'm not 100% sure, for those who know his work. So he brings this comment from Rav Moshe Sofer. You may be familiar with the fact that in the Torah, Passover is a 7-day holiday. Sukkot is an 8-day holiday. 7 days plus Shmini Atzeret is an 8-day holiday. And Shavuot is a 1-day holiday. However, outside of the land of Israel, we tack on an extra day. The origin of the extra day concept, as explained in the Talmud, is because when you hit the new month, they originally would declare the new month based on witness testimony. They had seen the new moon. And until you had that testimony, you didn't know whether a month had 29 days or 30 days, because the period of the moon is 29 and a half days. So witnesses had to see it. It had to not be cloudy. They had to testify. They had to be cross-examined, and so on and so forth. So you didn't know until that day. And they initially, they had a very good way to broadcast the message that everything had been set. They used bonfires on the mountaintops. That was actually a lot faster than Roger's last Friday. You lit a bonfire, they saw on the next mountaintop, they're ready and waiting. They lit it, and they lit it, and they lit it, and that way word got out. But there were issues of sabotage. The early Christians, as well as certain sects among the Jews, wanted to disrupt the rabbinic calendar. And so they ended up needing to switch systems because the bonfires were being sabotaged. And instead, they sent out riders who would go notify everybody. But how far can they get? And the result was a concern that people won't know in time. And so they said, you know what? I don't know if the last month was 29 days or 30 days, so I'm just going to observe an extra day, and that way I'm safe. Whether it was 29 days or 30 days, that's what I'm going to do. That practice went on for centuries, to the point where even after they stopped using witnesses and they had a fixed calendar, by the time you hit the Talmud, they're already using a fixed calendar, the Gemara's time, they said, this already has been our custom for centuries, that we keep an extra day. We have an 8th day of Passover. We have a 9th day of Sukkot. That's just the way we do it. And so they said, we keep on doing it. And there was an added notion of, you know, who knows what's going to happen. At some point, we could lose track of the calendar. You know, when you think of Jews in the camps, right? How in the world were they going to get a Jewish calendar to know when Rosh Chodesh was? Exactly. But those who specifically said, we want to observe, and you know all these stories about people making matzah and so on, like, what were they going to do? They cared. It mattered to them. Leave aside whether, you know, that was expected of them.
Thankfully, we don't have two Yom Kippur.
Right, and that's actually a legal discussion about that, why we don't have two Yom Kippurs. Don't worry, though, we're not. But I bring all of this only because one might have expected that in the future Messianic time, there's no need for a second day. Right? You're done. Number one, because we will have, you know, even if we restore doing it via witnesses, we'll have telecommunications. Everybody can know instantly when the new moon has been declared. And you don't need second day. That's number one. Number two, in addition to that, they're all going to be in the land of Israel. Who needs a second day? Rabbi Moshe Sofer says no. Second day is going to persist. And he draws on a passage in the Talmud in Masechet Gittin. And the Talmud there talks about, you have to envision a world map here. For this, Zoom would have been better because I could have shared screen with a map. But nonetheless, if you can picture the land of Israel, right, at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, right, and now envision going west in the same latitude, there are certain islands that you will eventually hit until ultimately you hit the Straits of Gibraltar and the entrance to the ocean, right? So there's a position in the Talmud that Israel has marine rights, right? Not just for the big gas fields, but the islands that are west of Israel are also part of the land of Israel. Now, again, blaming my New York upbringing, I'm not so map familiar to know where the latitude is, let's say, for where the bottom of England is. Whether England gets down there, parts of England could actually be considered part of the land of Israel in the future. Well, take a look at source number 14. Look what I translated for you here from Rabbi Sofer.
Florida would be.
He says, commenting on the term in the Talmud of Yom Tov Sheni or Shnei Yamim Shel Galuyot, two festival days of the diaspora. In my humble opinion, he said, this description is the name in the diaspora about the past. That's what those days are pre-Messiah. It's called 2 days of the diaspora. For so it was that the emissaries reached the edge of the land of Israel and some places outside Israel, and the only ones who observed 2 festival days were those who lived in the distant diaspora. But it appears to me that when God expands our borders speedily in our days, he said that in the beginning of the 19th century, then also all of the islands in the Mediterranean that are opposite Israel, to the western edge, the ocean, all will be part of Israel. And he quotes you the Gemara in Gittin, the Talmud in Gittin. It appears that in the future, no one disputes that this territory, there is a dispute about the status of those islands, but he says no one disputes this will be like the land of the 10 nations in any case. And what he means by that is God promised Abraham what the world today calls Greater Israel, an Israel which will extend from the river of Egypt, which seems to be the Nile, to the Euphrates. So that's the land of the 10 nations. If so, these islands in the sea, even via bonfires, one cannot notify them. You can light bonfires on the mountains, but, you know, I'm in the height of technology in 19th century Pressburg, you know, and I know there's no way to notify people, even if you light bonfires.
There is. It's easy.
Hot air balloons. Sorry?
Drugs.
No, but I'm saying in 19th century Pressburg. He says there's no way that people in those islands will know when the new moon was sighted. So it must be they will observe 2 festival days, not Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyot, but Yom Tov Sheni Shel Ge'ulot. He says it will be a second day of redemption. That's what he said. Ge'ulah is redemption. It will be 2 days because of redemption. So along with that, and this is the point that Professor Shapiro was making in his article, where Moshe Sofer is assuming that Jews are going to be living in those places. Right? It's not going to be the Cypriots who are observing a second day. It's going to be the Jews who are living in that land. So the hold on a minute. So the question that I want to come back to is, does this mean that a Jew may remain in the diaspora? Or will you say no, it's only because that land is like Israel, those islands are like Israel, and therefore you can be there, but no Jews in Canada? That's the question that I'm looking to address. Yes, Moshe.
Actually, that's the question I wanted to answer. Because I think that it will be very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
For all the Jews to be in Israel, and I'm not even talking about a Holocaust scenario or an Iran scenario, but it will be smart to have strategic emplacements of Jewish
colonies,
groups within all the countries, and regardless, we'll be like back at the beginning of Israel's beginning when we went down to Africa and helped out all those countries. So we'll be there also. So
you raise an important point, and that's where I'm going with this. Would it really be good if all Jews were living in the land of Israel? Moving the world's Jews to Israel makes the time of the Messiah look like paradise, not only for us, but for our worst enemies.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, all those people who don't like it when Jews put up an Eruv, right? Or who don't like having a Sabbath elevator in their building. Or they draft zoning laws so that there shouldn't be too many synagogues in an area. Or, you know, the school boards and the universities who are so frustrated about Rosh Hashanah and exams and you know, all of those things. Like, they'll be really, really happy when the Messiah comes. Their land is now Judenrein. I mean, they have no Jews. That's what they would really like. Would we view that as a good thing? Yes. Well, you're a Satmar Chassid in that regard. That was the Satmar Rebbe's argument. I mean, he had numerous reasons why he didn't like the founding of the State of Israel. But one argument that he made was you make yourselves vulnerable by having all these Jews gathered in one place. That was his consideration. So the answer to this question of whether we're really all back there, and if so, how do you deal with the fallout of not having Jews elsewhere, may depend on how we view the land of Israel and how we view diaspora existence. One approach to understanding the diaspora is that it is punishment, right? We're being banished from the land because we sinned. I gave you one reference in source number 15, when God says, when you violate our covenant, you I shall scatter among the nations, I will unsheath the sword after you, your land shall be in ruins, your city shall be destroyed. It's a punishment. You're getting zapped. If so, then the return from exile is simply relief from punishment. Now you can come back if you want. Maybe Allah will restore its flights from Canada. Who knows? It's an option. It's not a religious duty. You could live wherever you want. You could live in Toronto if you feel like it. You're just no longer kicked out of the land. That's one way to look at it. A second way to look at Galut, at the diaspora existence and the return, is that our exile is not so much punishment as consequence. It's disqualification from residency in Israel. If you are impure, then you get exiled from the land. In the future, you are now pure again, and therefore you're able to return. But again, you're not obligated to do so. You can go for a visit, and then you can leave, and you know, you're qualified to be there, but not required to be there. That's a second approach. But I would take a third approach. It's a very different view of diaspora existence, but it's based on an idea found already biblically and certainly in the Talmud. And that is the goal of diaspora existence is for the Jews to influence the rest of the world. If you go back to Genesis 12:2, if you take a look at source number 16, God says to Avram and Sarah, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will elevate your name, and you should be a blessing. Rashi comments, as I brought you there on the sheet, the blessings are in your hand. Until now, they were in my hand, right? Until you get to that passage in the Torah, the only ones who get blessings are people who God blesses. Now suddenly we find human beings conveying bracha, conveying blessing. I bless Adam, I bless Noah, and I bless you. And now you will bless those you choose. So at that point, we are supposed to become a blessing for others. That's the goal. Those of you who were in my Tuesday afternoon class this year, we learned about King Solomon and how during his reign we briefly reached that point where we were a blessing for everybody else before, you know, it all collapsed. But the Talmud says that continues when we go into exile. Source number 17. Israel was exiled among the nations only, key word, only. This was the only reason, so that converts would be added to them. We were supposed to be able to be, as they say, the line in Isaiah, a light unto the nations. There's some dispute as to how to translate that line in Isaiah, but that's the common translation of it. We could no longer do that as a society in our land. Now we had to do it as individuals living outside of the land of Israel, sanctifying God's name. Within that view, we return to Israel with the same mission. Right, to spread blessing as a nation. That's what we're, you know, that's what we're trying to accomplish. I brought you from Isaiah chapter 2 in source number 18, the classic lines. In the days to come, the mount of the Lord's house, this is the JPS translation. Sorry, I got tired of doing translations. The mount of the Lord's house shall stand firm above the mountains and tower above the hills. All the nations shall gaze on it with joy. The many people shall go and say, come, let us go up to the mount of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may instruct us in his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For instruction shall come forth from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Right? Swords into plowshares, the whole bit. But everybody now is going to be enlightened by this nation that has returned to Israel. And in order for that to succeed, hang on, Jonathan, in order for that to succeed, we need to create a society of tzedakah u'mishpat, of righteousness and justice, of a commitment to this shared Jewish vision. We need to create a government, a land that represents Judaism in the best of ways. We would need to create a Zion and Jerusalem, like source number 19, the verse in Song of Songs, is the description of God and the Jewish people as the beloveds of each other. And the Jewish people are seeking their beloved. They're seeking God. And the nations say, why? Why are you seeking this God? Why is your God special? As it's worded in Song of Songs in 19, how is your beloved different from any beloved, you who are the most beautiful of women? How is your beloved different from any beloved that you have sworn us thus, that we should help you find your beloved? And there in Song of Songs in Shir HaShirim, we give an answer for what we find special about God. We need to create a nation that answers the question of what is special about God. And that means we need, you know, the plumbers and the computer programmers and the doctors, the urban planners and the artists and even the politicians, all of them to join this national enterprise to become light unto the nations.
A lot of the biggest inventions were made by Jews.
And some that weren't made by Jews, but I just want to get to answer our question, and then Jonathan had a question, and Betty, and I'll take all the comments. But within this vision, we don't want Jews to opt out, right? We don't want a situation in which we're staying in Toronto or Russia or wherever else. We need all hands on deck. Now, does that mean the Jew haters will have a holiday because now they don't have any Jewish neighbors? Far from it, because instead of having us as their neighbors, now we'll just be all over the airwaves. We'll be, you know, it's going to be far from an era of paradise, because they're not going to be able to escape word of this righteous land that is a model for everybody else. It'll be in their digital newspapers. That's what you'll end up with is a society which is a blessing for the world, radiating from one place. That's my understanding of what this vision is meant to be. Jonathan.
I agree with what you say. The question is, we compared to Christianity or Islam, we don't take converts. We make it very difficult, which it would seem if we brought in converts as part of it, you would tend to be more of a light unto the nations because you bring people.
Right. So we do take converts.
We do.
But we don't pursue them.
We don't pursue them. It's more difficult than saying blah, 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 you're a Christian.
Yes. No, that's true. It is definitely an arduous thing, and some courts are a little bit more welcoming than others, and that's the last thing I'm going to say on that. But we accept them, we don't pursue them. That's to me is a big difference. We believe that somebody who's not Jewish can live a righteous life, fulfilling the laws that God set down for humanity as a whole, there isn't an imperative that they need to accept Judaism. Will they in the future is a separate class, which I've given before. Will they, in fact, is there an expectation? Does Isaiah think that the nations of the world, when they fulfill this vision, coming to Zion to learn, are they going to become Jewish? That's a fascinating discussion in its own right. Betty. Yeah.
If everybody, the fighting is going to be, astronomical because
yeah.
There's already how does that ever work?
Right. And the only answer I can offer is what Maimonides' vision is of this time when we talked about how what he envisions for a Messiah. This is a Messiah who is going to have a vision that he puts forth in some kind of persuasive way. He's not going to have an army to do it. He's going to be somebody so persuasive that everybody says, this is what we want to do.
Oh, so everybody is going to agree that...
And if that ain't the time of the Messiah, I don't know what is.
That's right.
I understand the problem. I understand the problem. Janine.
From number 18, it doesn't sound like we will stay dispersed. It sounds like the inspiration is coming from one place, from
yeah.
the usual line. But it doesn't mean that we have to be in those countries.
Oh, no. Correct.
But until like recently, let's say Washington, everybody left. Well, everybody left.
Yeah.
Washington.
No,
so
that's...
Wrong,
right. The gone but not forgotten. I don't think this is seeing us as dispersed. I don't think so. I think that the vision is that we're all back. Okay. So I had a few more things I wanted to get to when we have only 9 minutes to go, but I want to get to at least some of this. I wanted to walk you through Abarbanel's 1503 prediction for when the Messiah is going to come. Because I referenced it very briefly when we were talking about specific dates. I wanted to show you where this comes from. There are two passages in Daniel, that are relevant here. If you take a look at source number 20, at my translation from Daniel chapter 7, before this passage, right before this passage, Daniel declares that he had a vision of four beasts, each one representing one of the historic oppressors of the Jewish people. And all the commentators discuss, this one was Babylon, and this one was Greece, and this one was Rome, and whatever. But in this passage that we're looking at, he receives an explanation from an angel of the fourth beast that he sees. And words toward heaven he will speak. This fourth beast is going to speak against God. He will wear out the holy celestial beings. He will think to alter times and law, which commentators understood to be the Christian attempt to get rid of the Jewish calendar. The Jews will be given into his hand until a time, times, and half a time. And justice will convene, his power shall be removed, then it will be destroyed and eliminated to the end, and monarchy and power and greatness of monarchy beneath the entire heavens I have given to the nation of the holy ones of the heavens. His reign, meaning God's reign, shall be eternal, and all power shall serve him. And actually, no. Is that God or is it the Messiah? I think it's the Messiah. Will reign eternally. All power shall serve him and heed him. That's your passage. So there is a period of a time, times, and half a time. So what does that mean? Don Isaac Abarbanel did the heavy lifting, and he collected three different views. He actually brings more, but I brought just these three in source number 21. You have Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra, who says this vision is not about the Messiah at all. He didn't think it was about the Messiah. He thought it was about the siege of the Second Temple period, of the Second Temple, by the Romans. In the Greek time, not the Romans, but in the Greek times. And he says it means a siege of 3.5 years by the Greeks. That's the way that Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra reads it. A time means 1 year. The word in Aramaic, because this passage in Daniel is in Aramaic, the word for time is Idan. Right? Those who have been learning with Idan, Idan is time. So, a period of time. So, a time is 1 year. So, Idan, Idanin, a time, times, and half a time is 3.5 years. That's why he takes it. However, others disagree. Rabbi Sajagon, Rashi, and Don Isaac Abarbanel all give different approaches to this. Rabbi Sanjagon and Rashi say, this is a period that is meant to be after the destruction of the Second Temple, and the time that it's referring to is the period from the Exodus from Egypt until the First Temple was destroyed, because Daniel is speaking after the destruction of the First Temple. You have to know that, otherwise this doesn't make any sense. With it, it may not either, but certainly without it. So, a time is the length of time from when we got out of Egypt until the first temple was destroyed. That period, we are taught, is 890 years. That's the period that we're talking about. So the way that they take that is a time and half a time. That's what they end up with, to reach a total of 1,335 years, according to Rabbi Sadegon and Rashi. That's their read, the second of those options. Total of 1,335. And you count from the destruction of the Second Temple, which they placed in the year 68 to the year 70. So if you add 1,335 to the year 68, you will end up with 1,403. That's when they say that that it's going to come. Now, Rabbi Sadegon lived in the 10th century. Rashi lived in the 11th century, and their calculation said it's going to be in the year 1403. That's when the Messiah is going to come. That was their calculation. I also noted a little briefly here, when God predicts exile for the Jews, and he says that we're going to be exiled, he says, I'm going to hide my face from them. And okay, haster astir. That's a reference to the time of exile. So the gematria, the numerical value, if you remember, we did the numerology series. So the gematria of haster astir is 1336, which is very close to 1335. The period of exile will be 1335, 1336. You can hedge a little bit. It has to be that precise. It's not like they had digital watches. That's a second school of thought. But Abarbanel says, no. You know what a time is? A time is the length of the first temple. The first temple stood for 410 years. So a time times and half a time. So 410 plus 410 is 820, plus another 410 is, do the math with me, 1230, and then half of that, so 205 more, and you end up with 1435 years. So add 1435 to the year 68, and you end up with 1503. That's one. But he says it's not just from there. If you take a look at source number 22, Daniel chapter 8. Chapter 8 is supposed to fill in the gaps from the vision in chapter 7, explaining that vision. And he says, Daniel says, I heard one holy one speak, an angel, and one holy one said to Palmoni, which is also a term for, and it means another, like Ploni Almoni. Palmoni is another. One holy one said to Palmoni, which is this other angel, who spoke, until when is the vision of the continuous offering and the sin of the desolation, placing the sanctuary and the multitudes for trampling? Meaning, how long will we no longer have the temple sacrifices? How long will we be in exile, trampled by others? And he said to me, until evening, morning, 2300, then shall the sanctuary be set right. What in the world does that mean? So if you flip the page, I brought you a few different approaches to that. The first approach, Rabbi Avram ben Chia Nasi, he lived in the 11th century into the 12th century. He said 2300 years from when the first temple was built, which brings you to about the year 1370. Ralbag, Gersonides, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, said it's 2,300 years from the days of Samuel, who anointed the first king. So that takes him to the early 14th century. Nachmanides, Ramban, says it's 2,300 years from the times of King David, middle of the 14th century. None of them dealt with the problem of what is evening morning. What is that about? So Don Isaac Abarbanel said, I'll tell you. The word for evening in Hebrew is what?
Erev.
Erev is a period of darkness and confusion, irbuvia, a mixture. For those who are in my Agnon class on Monday night, we mentioned it there. Irbuvia is chaos and everything being mixed together. And he says that's Erev. That's the period of destruction, of darkness. Boker, on the other hand, is the word that we use for morning, right? Boker is levaker, means to examine. Bikur cholim is visiting the sick. It means examining the sick, looking after them to see how they are. So it's a period of shining light. So what this 2300 is about is that there's a period of exile that is followed by redemption. And he says it starts from when the Jews initially go into darkness, which is when we split our kingdom between the northern and southern kingdom, which he says is the year 2965. After King Solomon, when the kingdom splits, that's when the darkness period starts, and he does his math, 2,300 years from then, and he comes out again with 1503. And that's when we will be reunited. So what he's saying is darkness, then morning, are all part of the 2,300 years. And the it begins from that darkness of when the Jewish people split. That's the idea. So I ran through that a little bit quickly. I hope that it was somewhat something. But those passages in Daniel are what lead to this idea. In conclusion, I'll just note, I said to you in the first session or the second session, source number 24, Jacob wanted to tell his children what would happen at the end of days. And the Midrash says, and he doesn't. I mean, he gives them blessings which have prophecies in them, but nothing about the Messiah that is at all clear. And the Midrash says it's because God doesn't want him to tell. What was the debate between Jacob and God? Why does Jacob want to tell, and why does God not want him to tell? Three approaches, very quickly, because this is it for the summer. Number one, first approach, it's about Jacob saying the old era is ending. They're going into exile in Egypt. They're going to be slaves in the land of Egypt. The old era is going. I have to make sure information that's important isn't forgotten. I need to convey it. I have to make sure they will have a tradition. And God's response is it's not going to work that way. They're not just going to receive a transmission. They have to work on it and rebuild it themselves. That's one approach. God says they're not getting it so easy. You don't get to give them that information. Second approach, Jacob is saying, I want them to have hope that redemption is coming. Let me give them this information that says there is a Messiah. You can still, you know, you can still hope. And the response that God is giving is that if you give them that prediction for the future, then they're just going to think, well, that's happening in 1503. That's, you know, who knows when that's going to happen. We need the benefits of anticipating it today. If we live in the future, we lose hope for today. And then the last approach that I want to bring is that it's about Jacob coddling us. By saying to us, there's going to be a Messiah and this is when God is going to do it, it's saying God's going to bail you out. However bad things get, whatever it is that happens, don't worry about it. God is going to take care of you. And God's response is they need to feel it's up to them. They have to feel like it's on their shoulders in order to do this. If they're waiting for the Messiah to show up and God's going to handle it, that washes their hands of any responsibility. They need to know it's on them to create the future.
That's kind of like number one, same idea.
So, well, number one is just about information. Just telling them information and God saying they need to learn this themselves. That's the difference between them. I mean, these are all three ideas of mine. I'm not, I have rabbinic sources that link to each of them, but I knew that I wasn't going to have the time to go through it, so I didn't bother to bring it. Like the first approach about the information, the Gemara in Bava Basra talks about how Moshe was like the sun and Joshua was like the moon, and information was lost when Moshe died, and we have in various places in the Talmud. So yeah, there are sources that support each, but fundamentally, you know, you can take it or leave it. These are ideas that I'm promoting. I wish everybody a good summer. Thank you so much for being here in person. I love the discussion that goes on when we're together.
Is there any other prediction?